You're listening to The Chain, a science podcast where we bring what is new in biologics and protein engineering to the community of scientists working in this field. We discuss the latest developments with leaders who are on the front lines of cutting-edge research. On episode 8, associate producer Hannah Loss is speaking with Dr. Javin Oza. He is an assistant professor of chemistry and biochemistry at the California Polytechnic State University. They discuss Dr. Oza's work to democratize cell-free synthesis and improve access to the technology for a range of bioengineering applications.
Thanks, Javin, for taking time today to speak with us.
Oh, you're welcome. It's my pleasure.
So I'm intrigued by the homepage on your lab's website, especially the quote from Theodore von Karman. It says, "Scientists see the world as it is. Engineers create the world that never was." Can you tell me more how this relates to the goals of your research?
Yeah, absolutely. I came across this quote a few years ago, and it resonated with me immediately, mostly because of an observation I had, which was, and scientists are usually separated from engineers, you know, even literally physically. On most campuses like mine, the science buildings are on a completely different side of campus as engineers. We attend different conferences, etc. Yet, any advance in society actually takes both approaches, right? So why do we create these artificial boundaries? And that kind of intrigued me a little bit. And so the best example of integrating these to actually change society and science, I think, is the microscope, where, you know, the microscope was an engineering advance, and that allowed us to see a whole new world and see our world at a whole new scale. And once we appreciated that these things called cells even existed, and maybe there's even something smaller than that, right? That understanding by scientists using this technology prompted engineers to go back and build better microscopes. Right now, we have such a high resolution, we can appreciate disease cells from healthy cells, different cell types, etc. I think over the decades, that engagement between scientists and engineers has been transformative for a variety of reasons. So, you know, I really liked that integrated approach. I think that's really the right way in the coming generation to solve the next generation of problems. And so, you know, the way it relates to our work is trying to stay integrated, right? Try not to get siloed as much as possible. And so we try to integrate biological engineering and engineering type thinking to do hypothesis-driven science. And so given that we're a primarily undergraduate institution, we use research as a teaching learning platform. But we also try to do meaningful research that advances science and technology along the way.
That's great. It's nice to hear about programs that are, you know, working together, like you said, to advance society. So in your words, I guess, what distinguishes scientists and engineers? Why do you think there have been, you know, separation in the past?
Yeah, I should preface by saying I was trained as a scientist and not so much an engineer. Engineering thinking is something I've adopted because I see the power of it. So engineers out there may or may not agree with my perspective. I want to throw that out there. But I think that the distinction and the separation might have been historical, where we had these academic academies that, you know, just evolved separately. I think the interesting thing is how they're different, right? Even though I may not appreciate why they've been separated. I think scientists and engineers approach a problem from different perspectives. Scientists might seek to understand or define the problem, maybe identify root cause of a problem. And an engineer might seek to use or develop tools to reduce the problem or maybe minimize the impact of that problem towards some common goal. I think the climate change grand challenge is great example of this, where scientists are working to model the problem, identify root causes, etc., while engineers are building green technologies to address root causes, like renewable energy technologies, and maybe even to say, well, can we just minimize the problem or the impact of the problem and just go to Mars instead? Right. And I think the integration of both of those is really going to be required for a real meaningful solution.
Climate change is a great example. That's something that I hadn't put together having those two scientists and engineers. So can you, how, relating to protein engineering and your research in cell-free protein synthesis, how might an engineer approach the research problems in cell-free protein synthesis versus a scientist?
Yeah, I think the cell-free protein synthesis biotechnology platform is a particularly interesting example. I would say that this particular technology has been an outcome of a true integration of both. You know, this technology is not new. It's over 50 or 60 years old. It was the earliest way that we could understand what the genetic code was, how it functioned, etc. All those discoveries were done in cell-free decades ago. But to bring it to a level where we can use it readily for a variety of applications has taken both scientists and engineers. So scientists have approached a problem making hypotheses about, what are the rate limiting steps of transcription and translation, especially in a test tube outside of a cell? What type of energy metabolism could be limiting, right? Why are reactions not long lived? Why do they end in just 30 minutes to a few hours? And those are the types of questions scientists posed. And as we began to understand those systems better, engineering type thinking was not separate, right? It was integrated in saying, well, if we appreciate what the limiting step could be, can we tune it? Can we optimize it? Can we integrate design, build, test cycles to make this platform a longer lived reaction where we can get more protein out of it? Can we have more protein produced so that this platform can be competitive with existing in vivo expression technologies? And in many ways, we're quite close. So I think it's really been an integration, which is so exciting about it.
We hope you're enjoying this episode of The Chain and wanted to let you know about an event coming to San Diego in January. The 19th annual Pep Talk Conference is taking place January 20th through the 24th in sunny San Diego, California. You can save up to $300 by taking advantage of the early registration rate available until October 25th. If that's not enough to spend a week in winter in Southern California, you can save an additional $100 on registration with the code POD100. That's POD100. Head over to chi-peptalk.com to learn more about Pep Talk, the Protein Science Week.
In your lab, or perhaps with people that you've worked with, what are some barriers to implementing cell-free protein synthesis in the lab?
Yeah, I think this is a big one. Right. And I think that's an important question, especially since I think we hear two types of rhetoric. One is, well, cell-free is so great. It's easy to use. It's plug and play. And those things are true. And the other rhetoric is it's not easy to implement. It's actually hard. It's expensive. And that can be true as well. And so how do we break the barriers that that maybe make it easy for everybody to implement and make it more cost-effective? I think the National Institute of Standards and Technology has done a really great job recently of gathering players in the cell-free field to come together and identify those limits. They put out a report recently for those in your audience who may be interested, and they identify a lot of these barriers. Two of those barriers that we've experienced as well, the first is lysate preparation, right? So the entire biotechnology of cell-free protein synthesis is built on basically killing the cell but keeping the machinery alive, right? So extracting the catalyst from inside the cell and using it on demand in a test tube at a later time and point in time. So how do you do that? How do you kill the cell but keep the machinery alive? How do you prepare this extract so it's robust? And those preparation methods are not standardized. They can be expensive, and they can be quite irreproducible. The step forward is there are kits that are available, especially for new users to break down that barrier. You can just purchase a kit and try it, see if it's going to be a technique that's useful for any one scientist. The downside of those kits is that they can be expensive, perhaps prohibitively expensive. The kit nature of it makes it limited in application and generally not customizable. And so you know, those are kind of the barriers. And so my group, having identified those barriers for ourselves, have invested heavily in overcoming these limitations. And we have a few different projects kind of working toward that. The other limitation is DNA template preparation. So if you have this tube that essentially harnesses the genetic code in that test tube, you can initiate the reaction by simply adding a DNA template. And this template could be a plasmid DNA, a linear DNA. So the flexibility is great. But turns out that the DNA preparation matters. And so the quality of the template surprisingly varies from DNA preparation kit to kit, user to user, batch to batch. And that's actually not so great for the field, right? Especially to convince everybody, hey, how great it is, and how easy it is. So that's a current barrier. The other barrier in line of the DNA itself is certain plasmid backbones are superior than others. And to my understanding, it's not clear why. And we're kind of working on resolving that as well. So for example, if someone who does protein expression in vivo, let's say in E. coli cells currently, and they want to switch to cell-free, let's say maybe for higher throughput screening and discovery, and they have all their genes cloned into a PET vector, well, PET vectors surprisingly don't work so well. And so now there's another barrier that they have to clone everything into a better vector for cell-free. And is that cloning worth it for simply trying out a new platform? Maybe the answer is no for some people. And so that's a huge barrier. And sometimes DNA storage can be an issue. DNA can absorb onto the tubes. So your DNA concentration actually changes over time and things like that. So I think to me, those are the two primary bottlenecks in broad adoption. And there are others, but I think if we can resolve these two, then other issues like quality control, standardizing, quantification, those types of things are easier resolved.
Yeah, the data piece I hadn't thought about, but it seems to be a recurring theme. Speaking with researchers who are working with new processes, just processing and quantifying, like you said. So you mentioned the kits, which are good for new users of cell-free protein synthesis, but are there any other resources available to help those who are starting to transition or experiment with this system?
Yeah, absolutely. I think the kits are a great starting point. The things that a new researcher in the field should really think about is be application driven, right? What is it that cell-free is going to provide for them that other technologies, maybe the ones they already use, are insufficient for, right? So what are they actually looking to gain? And once they clearly identify that goal, then they can zoom in on, well, what type of cell extract are they going to use? Is it going to be an E. coli cell extract? Is it going to be a wheat germ extract? What are the strengths and weaknesses of a variety of them? I think identifying those upfront is going to be key. And the challenge, in speaking of barriers to entry, is that a lot of these bits of information are presented in disparate sources. So compiling, understanding, and identifying the exact extract to use can be a challenge, but is an essential first step. We've written a review paper recently that hopefully breaks down some of those barriers to help new users make those decisions. And there's actually a variety of really excellent reviews that provide an overview of cell-free and best practices. Right. So should a new user start with a kit or jump right into making a DIY extract on their own? And if they do make it on their own or purchase a kit, which cell type will they use to obtain extract from? And, you know, if it doesn't work on the first try, which new users should be patient with themselves, if it doesn't work the first few times, that's okay. But what type of technical details and considerations could enable a variety of successful outcomes? I think there are a set of really good reviews out there that can help new users through that type of thinking. Additionally, a few key players in the field have put out video tutorials through the Journal of Visualized Experiments, JOVE. So Vincent Norio's group, George Church, and our group, and perhaps others, have published these video tutorial publications that walk new users through step-by-step on how to prepare a reproducible cell extract that they can use. And because the community is growing and interest is growing, we have our first cell-free systems conference this year. And new users should check that out and perhaps attend.
That's exciting. Can you give the name of the review paper that your team recently published in case listeners want to check it out as a starting point?
Yeah, it's called A User's Guide to Cell-Free Protein Synthesis.
A User's Guide to Cell-Free Protein Synthesis. Great. I'm going to circle back to just the beginning. So, the integration of science and engineering. You mentioned that you are trained as a scientist. What advice would you give to a young scientist interested in protein science or any topic really, but who's weighing their options between, the engineering side and the lab science side? Although based on what you're saying, is there a choice that even needs to be made?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. Like you said last, I don't think those are mutually exclusive. And for maybe two reasons. One is any one project can have both aspects. But also, more importantly, a young scientist's path is going to be, go through multiple phases, right? They may even start early, let's say undergraduate research, but most likely graduate research and likely a postdoc. So what I recommend is try to focus each phase on training different aspects of their type of thinking, right? So maybe do a PhD in basic science and then go on to a postdoc where they apply that, or vice versa. Maybe spend their PhD developing new technologies or optimizing them using engineering type thinking, and then maybe a postdoc where they apply it to discover something new about the world. And the benefit of that is the more interdisciplinary a young scientist can learn to be, the more unique they'll be in being able to approach a problem. They'll be able to see a problem in a different way than others, right? That's going to give them a unique capacity to contribute to the advancement of science and technology. And I think that's really key. And as any one young scientist progresses down that path, I highly recommend reading broadly. It's common for any one person to kind of, become myopic and focused on just their immediate experiments at hand or their specific project and immerse themselves completely in that. I think it's really helpful to occasionally read really broadly and attend seminars that are outside of their core competency to see what else is out there. How can they connect their type of thinking to new problems? What new insights can help them with their problem? And ultimately, there's really no wrong path, right? And it's okay if their path is not linear. In fact, it's most likely going to be circuitous, as long as they have their goal in mind of what their core competencies are and how they want to expand those core competencies in a way that aligns with the problems they want to address in the world.
Javan, thank you so much. This was a great conversation.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Thank you for joining us on The Chain. Tune in next time for more conversations about science, research, and exploring the world of protein engineering.